Hello everyone, and welcome again to the Associate Affiliate Cricket Podcast. We have a big show today. We're talking about the ICC conference that was in Melbourne. We've got an interview with Shreya Khan, the media manager of the Asian Cricket Council, who had their annual general meeting shortly after. We have reviews of the ICC Europe Division 2, World Cricket League Division 4, and some Scotland and Netherlands one day matches, as well as other bits and pieces of news. And join me for that is my regular co-host, Andrew Nixon. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Russ. Hi, everybody.
Andrew, let's start with World Cricket League Division 4. It was probably the biggest event since we last spoke. We expected an extremely close tournament, and certainly that's what we got with the home teams coming in on top.
Singapore and Malaysia ended up meeting the final with Malaysia winning. Obviously, it's a second consecutive promotion for Malaysia. And probably the two best teams in the event. Denmark pushed them very close, but couldn't quite get into that top two. And Jersey were sort of pretty poor all around, and relegated back to Division 5.
Yeah, everyone won a game, though, and everyone lost a game. The net run rates, even if Singapore and Malaysia, were only 0.17 and 0.12. So it wasn't as if anyone kind of got away. It was probably a little bit of a surprise that Oman went down. Their net run rate was zero, so they just seemed to be unlucky in the close ones.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. I don't know whether it's a case of Oman just perhaps one step too far for them. I don't know if it's actually come down Division 3, but they've actually dropped quite a little bit in the Asian tournaments recently, although they did play reasonably well in ACC Premier League. But I think they've lost a couple of players in recent years, and perhaps we're seeing them sort of drop to their actual level, really.
And the other two European teams, apart from Jersey, managed to stay up. Was that a surprise at all for you?
Not too much. I mean, Denmark, I think, got it for possible promotion, so they had Amjad Khan back. And I think, in general, the team seemed to be playing much better. There was one sort of little blip with the batting, but apart from that, the batting was a lot more steady than it has been in 50-over cricket in recent years. And obviously, Amjad Khan they didn't rely on him completely in the bowling stakes, and which is good to see. I think Denmark were a much improved team, no doubt due to the influence of someone like Jeremy Bray.
Yeah, it was a bit of, on the last day, they fortuitously, I guess, the teams with the three worst records were playing the teams with the three best records, and Italy defeated Denmark in that match, which in the end was good for both of those sides. Well, good for Italy anyway, because it meant they stayed up, because otherwise they would have gone down. But I guess Denmark in that game, that was where their top order did fail, and Freddie Crocker only made one. And I think they were 4 for 19 at one point, which I guess it shows you how close all these games are, that one little kind of batting collapse at the start is enough to stop you from being promoted.
Yeah, you're right. And it was really an innings of 73 for Amjad Khan that saved him. Obviously, Amjad Khan isn't exactly renowned for his batting, but obviously he got Denmark almost out of a bit of a hole then. But Italy sort of ran away with it when they batted, scoring their runs in about 42 overs, winning by 6 wickets. So yeah, very disappointing last day for Denmark, but I think Malaysia and Singapore, they deserve it to promoted sides.
Yeah, and they'll go on to Division 3. They won't be playing home in the next one. They'll be in Uganda, which I think that you'd probably say that both will struggle perhaps a little bit in that tournament.
Yeah, this will actually be the first time Malaysia have played a tournament outside of Asia since the 2001 ICC Trophy. And neither Malaysia nor Singapore have played in Africa since the 1994 ICC Trophy in Kenya. So this is very much a voyage into the unknown for these players, and I can't see them getting another promotion, although they'll certainly be hoping that at least one of them can stay up, but I would actually expect both those teams to come straight back down to Division 4, unfortunately. I suppose one of the keys for one of the aims of the World Cricket League when it was first set up, one of the stated aims by the ICC was to give more associates, more experience of playing in varied conditions around the world. And when you look at Malaysia, every single one of their World Cricket League tournaments has been in Malaysia or Singapore. For Singapore, apart from one tournament in Jersey in 2008, they've all been in Malaysia, Singapore, and then one in Nepal as well, so nearly all in Asia. And I think they need to try and find some other hosts for these World Cricket League tournaments that aren't, so they're not just relying on Singapore and Malaysia. It seems to be that if Singapore and Malaysia are in, then we'll host it there, and then they don't look elsewhere. And I think the ICC need to look at where they play these tournaments a little more to try and reach that stated aim of giving more teams more experience at playing in varied conditions.
Yeah, absolutely. We should also probably mention Singapore were led with the batting by Chaminda Kumaraj, who scored 343 runs at 85 throughout the tournament, with the only century. It was quite a low-scoring tournament, which is very impressive. Malaysia's batting again was pretty good, with Ahmed Fayez and Nasser Shafiq scoring heavily. So, again, to draw on the point you just made about local conditions, their ability to exploit those with the bat and with the ball. Charles Mears, Yusuf was the leading wicket taker for Malaysia with 16 wickets. Really kind of stood out.
Yeah, absolutely. The whole side always does well in World Cricket League tournaments. But as I say, it's a bit of a worry that Malaysia and Singapore are perhaps only able to perform in their home conditions because they're not getting that variety of conditions to play.
Moving on to ICC Europe Division 2, Andrew, we called this one pretty badly, I guess you'd say. We expected Germany to do well, and in the end, I believe they went winless.
Yeah, don't think this is our finest moment in punditry. Yeah. It's pretty terrible. Yeah, I don't think we've ever actually predicted a team as favourites, and then they've got relegated without winning before. So this, I think the only way is up from here, and very disappointing performance by Germany, it has to be said. They did have high hopes of getting promoted themselves, and obviously something's gone drastically wrong there. They've got a new coach, and whether he's just not gelled with the players or not, I don't know. But yeah, very disappointing performance by Germany.
The winners were Norway, probably completely opposite. We thought they'd do okay, but they really just stormed through this tournament.
Yeah, you're unbeaten throughout the tournament and won a couple of games quite convincingly as well. And I think we had sort of Germany and then maybe Isle of Man as the favourites, in Norway perhaps just bubbling under. But yeah, they did a lot better than I expected. You know, they pretty convincing throughout the tournament. They were winning games by 8 wickets, 9 wickets, and so on. And yeah, so certainly deserved winners. And be interested to see how they go in Division 1 next year.
Yeah, Belgium also played pretty well. Coming up, we expected them to do okay. In the end, they only lost the one game to Norway. And Austria probably surprised to come in third.
Yes and no. I mean, Austria have some very talented players. They've gone through a bit of a transition phase at the moment. We've got Andrew Simpson-Parker retired a couple of years ago, and he's no longer in the side. And a couple of other players have retired as well, and they've had some new players coming up from the youth setup. And you know, they're a little bit. I mean, I didn't think they'd get relegated, and you know, they finished third, so a decent performance by them, and you know, it showed that they had a good performance in Division 1 last year, where they finished, I think, 6th, maybe 7th, can't remember, but you know, they showed that wasn't a fluke, and they've you know, continued. You know, this, even though they're in Division 2 now, this is essentially the 8th, they're essentially ranked 8th within the teams that play in the European Championship now. And yeah, a very good performance by them, and surely we're very pleased to be staying in Division 2.
Yeah, another team I'll be pleased there is Gibraltar. And obviously not a very big nation at all, so this is probably their level. It'd be hard to see them moving up in the division.
Yeah, unless they get a sort of generation of very good players. They have the problem that they no longer take part in European youth tournaments, which to some extent with Gibraltar, and this may also end up affecting the Isle of Man eventually as well. Because obviously, you know, kids in Gibraltar will tend to go to university in England. That can end up meaning that they don't play any local cricket in Gibraltar, which will mean that this base will not meet the development criteria. And the only way in the past they would meet the development criteria for playing for the senior side would be because they played for the under 19 side. So therefore they automatically meet development criteria. But if there's no under 19 side for them to play in, they could find themselves struggling to get young players, and they could end up in a similar situation to, where, so obviously they're a different level of team, but where Nepal were about 10 years ago, where they were producing all these really talented youth players who then just disappeared into the, when they, before getting into the senior setup, and Gibraltar need to you know, do everything they can to try and get back into that official European youth setup.
And thoughts on Norway when they get down to Division One? Are they capable of staying up or causing any trouble?
Well, you know, the opposition is a lot stronger in Division One. You know, that goes without saying, but it is quite a large step up to Division One. They'll obviously be targeting France. They have been there or thereabouts equal with France in recent years, and you know, I don't see them competing with, you know, Denmark, Italy, Jersey and Guernsey. You know, that the game they play against France in Division One next year would probably decide who stays up, and may even decide who's in World Cricket League Division 6, which the talk is that whoever finishes best out of Norway and France in Division 1 will be in World Cricket League Division 6. Yeah, so I can't imagine them challenging for, you know, the one European spot in the World 2020 qualifier, but I'd be reasonably confident of them staying up, but it'll be an interesting game against France.
The other tournament, Andrew, that was on, in some ways the most high profile, was certainly the one I actually saw the most of recent times, because it was streamed online and from the beautiful Gravovasai ground in Romania, and it was part of the T20 International European Development Cricket League. It involved Romania, Hungary, Bulgaria, Serbia and Russia. Romania came through. One thing I did notice is, they seemed to be quite loose with the criteria of who was eligible. So you were watching the Serbian national team, which is very much a homegrown team, playing against a largely expat team and probably outclassed significantly in those matches.
You know, they lost a couple of their games quite heavily as well. I unfortunately wasn't able to follow this as much as I liked, as I was up in Glasgow at the time. And you know, in many ways, it's good that these teams are still playing. Although some of these teams aren't IC members, of course. Obviously, they still want to be playing international cricket, and because they're not getting the opportunity through formal ICC competition, they're gonna play themselves. And you know, the aim of getting teams to spend their money on development rather than playing in tournaments simply isn't working.
Yeah, one other thing, as I said, it was streamed and it was a very well received stream. It was watched by, you know, a few random people on Twitter that kind of came across it. So I think the ICC needs, in fact, all the ICC regions need to stop making excuses for not having broadcasts of their own tournaments. I think if you can stream a tournament from some of the ICC's smallest members and non-members, you really should be able to do it for every single tournament that the ICC runs. ICC Europe Division 2 is a good example. It was that parts of it were held at the county ground in Essex, and it really, there's no excuse not to have a live stream of that kind of tournament.
Yeah, and Quickie TV were actually at that tournament filming things for highlights, and they're there. You know, why not pay for the extra internet bandwidth and stream it? And you know, if you're a little tournament in Romania, can have a nice simple single camera stream, then I don't think there's any reason why ICC Europe Division 2 or World Cricket League Division 5 that we've also, or World Cricket League Division 4 rather, that we've also reported on this podcast, can't also be streamed. You know, it doesn't have to be a full-blown production with your high-definition cameras and fancy on-screen graphics and whatnot. And you know, you can have a simple production, and I think perhaps some money needs to be put aside for doing that. And you know, maybe there's rights issues here. You know, for all we know, maybe ESPN actually owned the rights to all international cricket, and that's played under the ICC's remit, and you know, you're essentially having to subcontract those rights to another organisation. But you know, well, let's just do something to overcome that, whereby streaming can be set up very easily, and the ICC puts money aside for it. And as I say, it doesn't have to be a fancy production; just a nice, simple stream, and you know, people will watch. You know, a lot of people don't subscribe to sports channels that show cricket, and if something's free, they'll watch it. You know, and you know, it's all about, as we discussed earlier, promoting the game.
The other fixtures of major note, Andrew, with the Scotland and Netherlands one-day matches. They were split. It was a three-game series, but the final match was completely washed out. I think that was the one you were at.
Yeah, the one I travelled up for three and a half hours to go and see was the one that was washed out, unfortunately. But you know, that's cricket for you.
Yeah, Glasgow's very pretty in the rain. And but the other two matches, Netherlands won the first by 44 runs, which is quite a good effort from them.
It was actually quite a bigger win than that margin would suggest. You know, it scored 252 for 9 with Swart scoring 62. I was under the impression he'd actually stopped playing for the Netherlands, but obviously he's changed his mind on that. And then Scotland, who were going quite well at the moment, they were 157 for 2, and then there was a bit of a batting collapse, and they were bowled out for 208. Very disappointing collapse from them there.
Yeah, they turned it around the second game, though, scoring 317 in the first innings. McLeod scored 145, 124 balls, a really standard innings from him. And the Netherlands were not even close when it started to rain and washed it out after 22 overs.
Yeah, this is a pretty convincing win for Scotland. You know, that McLeod innings, I saw a bit of it on the Quippy TV coverage. It was absolutely superb. I think it's the second time he's had a similar innings, you know, to score 145. And should actually also mention Asad Malik's bowling. He took 6 for 50. Had this been an ODI, that would have been the first time an associate player had done that in an ODI, but unfortunately it wasn't an ODI because Netherlands no longer have that status.
Yeah, I should mention Leask's bowling as well. He's came on for his batting against England recently, but he took 4 for 19 off 6 overs in this game, as well as 2 wickets in the first. So very strong and deep batting lineup for Scotland with so many all-rounders in the lineup.
Yeah, things are looking very positive for the future for Scotland. This was the first series to their new coach, Grant Bradburn, I think his name is, and he'll have a very good idea of how his team are performing as they prepare for next year's World 2020 qualifier.
You mentioned status, Andrew. I guess you had a little bit of a run-in over how this was displayed as a match on major websites.
Yeah, specifically on Crick Info, where this game was just listed as other, but there was an international that day, apparently, which was between India and Derbyshire. I wasn't aware that Derbyshire had declared independence from the United Kingdom and become a country in their own right, but obviously apparently they have. But apparently the reason Crick Info lists that as an international is because India are a full member, so therefore any match they play, they'll list as an international. They could be playing against, you know, the local pub 11 on this tour, it would be an international as far as Crick Info are concerned. But Scotland v Netherlands, a match between two countries, apparently isn't an international just because Netherlands don't have a particular status. And of course, if this was a 2020 match, it would be an international. It would be a 2020 international, and none of this actually makes sense. It was advertised as an international locally. There's, you know, the posters up at the club were all saying Netherlands v Scotland internationals. You know, on the Cricket Scotland and KCV websites, they were listed as internationals. Everybody sees this as an international, except it isn't. And I think cricket must be the only sport where you can have a match between two countries played according to standard playing conditions, teams selected according to usual eligibility rules, and then all of a sudden it isn't an international, and that doesn't really make sense to me.
Yeah, I agree completely. We've talked about status a number of occasions here, and this isn't quite a status issue, although it is to an degree, because if it had one day status, it would have counted as an international for certain on Quick Info. And it doesn't make sense that there was fairly scant coverage as well of the ICC Europe matches going around, which again is kind of disappointing. You really want these World 2020 qualifying kind of smaller tournaments to be pushed forward and just to demonstrate that these matches are going on. And it's important, the ICC's kind of failing to push and release enough information on what's happening in them so that they're actually getting good coverage in the news media, because the news media won't necessarily cover it, but it's up to the ICC to take up the slack.
Yeah, Quick Info, even though it's, owned by ESPN, a huge conglomerate, international, multinational company, they do have limited resources. I don't for one minute expect them to be sending a scorer to every single, World 2020 qualifying match around the world. But that shouldn't mean they ignore it completely, which in a lot of cases they do, and I think it's a shame. These are the World 2020 qualifying matches, Europe Division 2. These are crucial matches with, real consequences, and, they should be covered by these websites, and it's a real shame that they're not. They deserve more publicity, and unfortunately, as you say, it's the ICC not publicising them enough. The press releases that are put out are often late, they're often not very good, full of, grammatical and typographical errors, and it's, the ICC aren't selling them enough. But, just coming back to this Netherlands-Scotland game, you've got that fantastic innings by Callum McLeod, you've got that, excellent bowling performance by Asim Malik, taking 6 wickets, and as far as their career records go, those performances didn't happen, and that's a real shame for the players.
Speaking of ICC doing what ICC does and doesn't do, one thing they did do was have a really big conference in Melbourne a couple of weeks ago, and it was marked in the media mostly because of the Big Three takeover and the changes to the governance and so forth, but quite a lot went on that would affect associates, and quite a lot was set up that will in the future affect associates, and it's not clear exactly what way yet because the ICC hasn't decided and there's been changes to the development committee. So start with a few smaller bits of news. The good news was Zaman was accepted as an associate, which we knew was going to happen, and USACA was put on notice for not being the sole governing body in the United States. It's not clear on USACA, though, how that's going to be handled. The governance committee was going to talk about it after the associate press conference was done, and then it was released that the West Indies Cricket Board will be taking a role in terms of doing something and helping resolve it, but it's actually not really clear at all what the WCIB will be doing in that sense.
Yeah, or indeed what they can do. The administration of USACA certainly leaves a lot to be desired, and just what exactly can the West Indies Cricket Board do? There's very little infrastructure now in US cricket because so many leagues have gone over to the American Cricket Federation, and you can't really see USACA becoming the sole governing body by this time next year, which would lead to them being suspended. And if they're suspended and lose their ICC funding, then you can't even see them existing in 2 years' time, and because they're so mired in debt. And I think in many ways the ICC would have been better just suspending USACA, expelling USACA straight away, and instead they've got this sort of 2 year essentially notice period, they'd be suspended next year, and then if still in violation then they'd be expelled in 2016. But of course, if they were expelled in 2016, that means that the American Cricket Federation couldn't apply to join the ICC until 2017. And even then, they'd only be able to join if they were the sole governing body. So if USACA still existed in some form, then the American Cricket Federation would be able to join the ICC. Essentially, this decision has put US cricket into limbo for 3 years, and it's hard to see what the West Indies Cricket Board can actually do to turn it around certainly within 3 years, never mind 12 months.
Yeah, one thing they will probably do is muddy the waters. They can put in a little bit of money and prop up the USACA if that was something they were putting. The WSOP is not particularly rich, but they can afford a couple of hundred grand here and there. They have indicated that they're interested in forming partnerships with USACA, and that there has been in USACA a certain political fault line between the Caribbean-based parts of the organization and the organization parts of the US cricket that have come from more subcontinental areas. And Gladstone Dainties has always been strongly aligned with the Caribbean, and this kind of indicates that he's kind of found a local governing body that is willing to kind of help him a little bit, and maybe they're going to try and just drag this out for a bit longer and see what happens. I'm not sure that, as you say, that they can actually resolve it, but they might stop USACA from collapsing completely.
Yeah, it's we could end up with a situation where, you know, once USACA has gone, the American Cricket Federation are just picking up scraps, and you know that's not what we want. I hate to sound like someone from the ICC, but the US is a great market, great potential market for cricket. You only need to reach 1% of the population, and you've got a similar sort of audience to New Zealand, for example. And it's worrying times for US cricket, but then it always is.
There was, along with USACA, there was a few other teams who were either put on notice or suspended. The most important was that Tonga was removed as a member.
Obviously very disappointing. Tonga being expelled because they don't meet the staffing requirements for an ICC affiliate member. They're supposed to have not necessarily a full-time administrator, but certainly a designated contact person, and they don't do that. There was a interview that circulated with an ICC East Asia Pacific representative on Australian radio last year, where he was asked, what are you doing for Tonga to help them, start meeting the staffing criteria? And they said, well, we're not doing anything. And obviously they didn't. And Tonga, of course, therefore stopped meeting the criteria and now been expelled. It's very disappointing for Tonga. Whether they'll still play in the Pacific Games cricket tournament next year, as I think they were planning on doing, remains to be seen. It's a non-ICC event, so hopefully they will. But very disappointing that, Tonga's a small country, and perhaps they can't have a permanent administrator. I suppose they should have at least a contact person. It's very, very disappointing. Turkey also faced expulsion, but obviously they, for not being the sole governing body, but obviously that has been resolved and they've not been expelled now. So we're at 105 ICC members for now, and perhaps more to leave in upcoming years.
Another piece of good news, the ICC is now reporting 1.1 million participants, and most of those are in junior development programs, unfortunately. Not actually league players, but it's still an increase, and it's good to see that there is that kind of groundswell, because that's important for the game to keep continuing forward.
Yeah, as long as these figures are accurate. I'm very sceptical about the figures that come out, because I've heard stories of people being asked to inflate the figures, and a lot of time it'll be sometimes it'll even be as simple as someone was shown a video of cricket at school, and then they'll count that as a participant. They'll have one quick cricket session or one indoor cricket session, and that's a participant. But it's about what we need to look at is how these participants at this level are being turned into participants at a senior level, how these one-off participants are being turned into long-term participants in the game. And I'm not sure that is necessarily being done, and whether it's being checked adequately.
Yeah, Certainly ICC understands that from what I've, when I've spoken to them about how the importance of moving these junior development participants into league. I think it's very difficult, and it'll be interesting to, when the census finds out its way to us, to kind of check and see what sort of growth. It hasn't been as strong in that area in the past as it has been in those development programs. So we certainly do need to see growth starting to occur there if we're going to actually see improvement.
Yeah.
The other piece of good news that we spoke, that there wasn't going to be much cricket for the Associates playing in the World Cup, but it does appear that there hasn't been dates confirmed yet, but there'll be a September-October tour for the four participants to Australia and New Zealand to help them prepare. They'll be playing each other in a few games.
I suppose it's good news. It would be better if they were getting matches against some of the full members. If you look at the sort of 12-month period leading up to the 2007 World Cup, then I think there was maybe almost 30 matches between associate members and full members. And if you look at the 12 months leading up to the 2015 World Cup, then I don't think there's even a dozen. So things that we need more matches against full members. We've got the series Afghanistan are playing against Zimbabwe later this month, but after that there's nothing on the schedule between associates and full members, which is very disappointing. You'd hope maybe they can perhaps, with them being in the area, maybe play a couple of games against Papua New Guinea. Obviously Papua New Guinea still not played an ODI since getting that status, and obviously they need some games. I think they talk about playing some games against Hong Kong later this year as well, so hopefully something will come of that. But yeah, very disappointing that they're not getting games with full members, and it'll be interesting to see what standard of opposition they get to play against in Australia. I mean, I heard it was going to be sort of grade cricket level, which is a little disappointing. I would have hoped that maybe a couple of matches against state sides, which I suppose would be in their pre-season at that point, so they would probably want some decent opposition to play against. It'll be interesting to see if that happens.
We had some clarification on 2020 international data, Andrew, that Netherlands and Nepal, along with the six ODI teams, will have 2020 status.
The ICC announced this during the ICC conference that they'd given Nepal and Netherlands 2020 international status. What they didn't announce was how long it's for. It's actually just until the qualifier next year, and after that qualifier, any team that qualifies for the 2016 World 2020 that doesn't have ODI status or 2020 international status already will then get 2020 international status for the next 4 years up until the following qualifier. So it's 2020 international status for 12 months. What can they really do in 12 months? Not a lot.
Yeah, I mean, status doesn't get you any games against full member nations. It just means your records go in the record book. So in a sense, it doesn't matter. They do obviously have to choose at some point if they're going to have status, and this is probably, I guess, the most sensible way. One thing that happened, Andrew, the Associates was spoken to by the members of the Big Three, Wally Edwards, Giles Clark, and Srinivasan, prior to their meeting. They were kind of talked it through and tried to sell, I guess, the changes that were going on. The bottom line from these discussions is, and from talking to people associated with ICC on this, is that people within ICC management don't know what is going to happen. There's a new development committee that will be headed by Srinivasan himself with other full members on it, and that is directly subject to, therefore, to the ExCo and then to the board. Those full members on the development committee aren't necessarily very familiar with associate and affiliate cricket, and therefore there's a fair bit of waiting going on until the end of the year to work out what changes might go on, what this new development committee will come up with, and what changes to the structure. There was none of that really discussed at the conference. It's just been put on hold until the end of the year while this new committee sort of gets underway.
One of the things that we have that has come out of it, apparently, Srinivasan is encouraging associates and affiliates to, and I'm quoting here from an article on Cricket Info, to devote time to tending their own backyards and trying to grow the game domestically rather than devoting all available money and energy to top-line qualification for overseas tournaments. That, to some extent, is a fair point. you know, more effort does need to become to grow out of the game domestically, and you know, not rely just on expats playing in some countries, and develop the game more in schools and whatnot. And but that doesn't mean you can't also then also try and qualify for tournaments. You can do both. The ICC has the money to be able to let these teams do both, but they'd rather keep it for themselves. And I think, you know, the message behind this, and when you look at what has actually happened to associates in and affiliate cricket in recent years, I think the message is that, you know, don't come and play in our tournaments. Don't ask for any money. Just concentrate on playing locally and don't bother us. Just let us run our sport ourselves. And don't even think about trying to qualify for tournaments. You know, I know the comments from Tim Anderson. Tim Anderson will talk about increasing opportunities for associates. And when you actually look at what's been done, that there isn't any increase in opportunities for associates. You know, the 50 over World Cup has been cut from 16 teams to 14 teams and now to 10 teams, so associates no longer guaranteed a place in it. The World 2020 has, on paper, been expanded from 12 to 16 teams, but, you know, as we discussed before, it's really been reduced to 10 because that first round is another qualifier, and it's only played every 4 years rather than every 2 years. World Cricket League has been cut from 8 divisions to 6 divisions. The Intercontinental Cup for the top associates was previously played every 2 years, now it's played every 4 years. So that's had the effect of halving the first class matches those teams are playing. Going lower down the pecking order, is 2020 cricket only in most ICC regions. About a third of associate and affiliate members are actually prevented from playing in regional tournaments now. And even fewer teams are allowed to play in youth tournaments. The only actual increasing opportunity is this vague promise of a pathway to test cricket. And yet again, from coming out of this, the details of what that pathway entails is still very, very vague.
As you said, there's two kind of philosophies that have actually come very strongly through from the comments by Tim Anderson and also the big three when they've talked about it. Is, as I say, they make a claim that there's been a package of opportunity that's improved, which doesn't really stand up to scrutiny, but their claim kind of revolves around the idea that even the full members have had their privilege weakened in a sense. And that's true in the sense that there has been a crack formed in it at the very, very bottom where you've got Bangladesh and Zimbabwe, which a lot of people within the full members don't believe should be full members anymore because they haven't managed to perform at the standard of the 8 teams above them. And so they've cracked that bottom very slightly, very, very slightly, and that may in the future open itself out to a more meritocratic system. But we are an awfully long way away from kind of developing those pathways that would allow it to be properly meritocratic. And certainly funding, it hasn't really changed a lot, and certainly fixtures hasn't changed a lot because they've locked in place for the next 8 years the full future tour program that is expanded again to fill up every available gap for all these full members.
Srinivasan gave an interview recently where he talked about, again, you know, more opportunities for associates and things like that. And, you know, people say, oh, look, he's actually all right. He wants to give more opportunities to my associates. But, you know, that's just talk. You know, let's judge them by their deeds, not by their words. And when you look at what's actually happened to associate cricket, then you can't possibly say that they're increasing opportunities. But the media, the general media buy that line, that they're increasing these opportunities and take them at the word. But those of us who actually follow associate cricket know that that's just nonsense.
As said too, the other philosophy that's been very strong is the importance of local development over playing these tournaments, and that's in a sense why all these tournaments have been reduced. I think the comment that was made to me was that there's a 70-30 split between tournament costs and development money going around that the ICC spends money on. Now, that doesn't include money that those nations get themselves, and a lot of that money, they can spend a lot of their money on their own development, and the ICC probably should be spending money on tournaments potentially, but they would like it to be closer to a 30-70 split the other way, and the only way to do that is to reduce the tournament costs.
Well, it's not the only way. You could give more money to development and keep the tournament costs the same. But obviously that would involve giving more money.
You could reduce the amount of money going to the BCCI. That is true. But if they keep the money at the BCCI the same, and we know that's probably most likely, they are going to have to reduce tournaments, or they're going to have to reduce the cost of tournaments. And at least at this stage, what they've been doing is reducing tournaments. There was a hint as well in Tim Ince's comments that the World Cricket League might continue to shrink further. He certainly didn't seem terribly sold on the idea of having six divisions, partly, I guess, because the ones even at Division 6 aren't playing a huge amount of 50-over cricket, and therefore, if the World Cup itself has been reduced to only 10 teams, then you've got a lot of divisions below that. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if one of the things they did was to reduce that down to 5 and then 4 even.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly heard a rumour of about a year ago now that Division 6 was going to be got rid of as well. And information about how teams are qualifying Division 6 is very hard to come by. You speak to people in the regions and nobody really seems to know. It's just sort of rumour and hearsay. So I can certainly see at least Division 6 going. But, of course teams in Division 6 aren't playing much 50-over cricket because they're not getting it regionally either.
That's exactly right. And the regional tournaments themselves are being reduced. And there are ways to do cheaper regional tournaments. The sub-regional, we're certainly seeing a lot of them being played by the members, and they're still spending a lot of their money on these tournaments. So it's something that we will expect is going to continue to happen because the ICC, in some sense, there's no point being a member of the ICC or even having a national committee unless you're forming a national team because you can play cricket in your backyard or in your local ground without any input from the ICC. So the ICC needs to realise that there's these opportunities to play within this structure, even if they're at a very low level of structure, needs to exist at some level in every nation that they, one of their members. Otherwise, it's hard to see why you would stay in the ICC and fulfil their requirements to be in the ICC if that's going to be the case.
That certainly seems to be the case. And, I'm a cynical person, as regular listeners certainly know. You have to wonder, is the eventual aim to get rid of some of these affiliate members? You see something of a divide and conquer strategy taking place at all levels of cricket. With the full members, you're depending on what the situation is. You've got the big three and the small seven, or the top eight, and then Bangladesh and Zimbabwe. Then your associates, you've got the associates with high performance funding, the associates without, and affiliates, you've got affiliates who can play in tournaments and affiliates who can't play in tournaments. We've essentially got six levels of membership now rather than three. And those affiliates who currently don't play in tournaments, is the aim to actually get them out of the ICC and so that the ICC doesn't have to fund them? The barriers for membership, the requirements for membership have been increased. A lot of current affiliate members wouldn't qualify on population grounds, for example. Certainly the smaller ones like the Falkland Islands or St Helena wouldn't qualify anymore as affiliate members. And the ICC might well turn around and say, well, look, you don't meet the current affiliate member requirements, so on you go, we're not interested anymore. And there's a definite move towards away from the expansionist agenda that we've had in recent years to a more reductionist one.
Other points that came out of this meeting, the ICC management feels that full members in the past haven't had much of a role in development in their regions, and there was a sense that they think that the executive committee now understands associate cricket a lot better, whereas previously they were completely ignoring it, and that they're willing for full members to take a larger role within their local regions, and that they're recognising that that's important. My worry, and it's something I expressed as questions to Tim Anderson, was that there's significant differences in the resources available to these different regions, particularly between Africa and America, so the two regions struggling the most at the moment, and it's hard to see how they'll pick themselves up if you're going to depend on the West Indies Cricket Board to do development in your local area when they can barely fund their own playing base themselves.
Yeah, and to some extent, why would your England really actually be interested in developing cricket in like, let's say, Gibraltar or Turkey or whatever? And they wouldn't. And so, beyond maybe picking players and whatnot, as they have done with Ireland's players. But, you know, it's hard to see why the full members would really be interested in beyond being able to scout for players. That comes across as being very cynical, but full members should be concentrating on their own backyards to some extent. And by all means, play these teams, invite them into your domestic competitions, but actually having a role in development, I can't see how that can actually be effective, because the full members will naturally concentrate more on their own developments within their own countries.
Yeah, it's also, I think, indicative of the fact that the ICC itself is being stripped down, that there's an expectation that the full members will take on things that the ICC itself should be doing, that the ICC regions should be doing, and then they're going to make the ICC a smaller organisation, and in doing so, give more money to the full members. But part of doing that is that the full members are expected to take on a larger role in the region, but it won't be defined what that role will be, and if they choose not to, then it's not a particular loss.
Yeah. People may have read an article I've written on Cricket Europe recently suggesting that it's time perhaps for the associates to realise that they're actually not ever going to get a fair deal from the ICC and break away from the ICC and set up a rival governing body for cricket. It's a very drastic... It would be a very drastic action to take, but you can't see associate cricket being able to develop properly with the current structure. But one associate representative was quoted by Cricket Info as saying, "We will be better off even if the governance model is unethical." And perhaps that just sums up what's wrong with cricket. Nobody really cares about ethics.
Yeah, certainly seems to be the case. One last point is, it was indicated by Tim Anderson that the performance of the World Cup will actually matter for perceptions. We kind of know that, but the indications that maybe it's not locked in for the 2019 via 10-team World Cup. It would surprise me greatly if they changed it, because they're so keen to have, and I'm sure they'll actually sell it to TV companies as a 10-team World Cup with India playing at least 9 matches. But also that the Olympics weren't discussed at the associate meeting and or the ICC conference, so that's again been put aside and for some future point. They do bring it up only to kind of say that it's not going to happen anytime soon. One last thing, there was that the indications in the ICC, they're going to be targeting investment at particular countries. They haven't said which countries they, or even decided what countries they'll be, but it would seem to be the countries that do well will probably receive a lot more money. We've certainly seen the expectations that Ireland and other top performing associates are going to get a lot more money, and it won't be as broadly spread.
Yeah, I'd question whether that's the right thing to do. To some extent, the money should be distributed on a needs basis, not necessarily a performance basis. And they had moved away from some extent from performance-based funding to this, obviously, the scorecard-based system of funding. Although performance still makes up in a large part of that scorecard system. But yeah, it puzzles me that you'd base funding on performance, because you can always inflate your performance by your large expatriate community that you have. So UAE is a prime example of this, where development of local players there is absolutely drastic. You see that. Maybe this is a partly due to the UAE's demographics. 80% of the population are expats, but they were unable to enter a team in the Asian Games because they can't get enough players with UAE passports, and that's a sign that local development is pretty bad. But because they've got such a high performance because of their expatriate and immigrant community, then they get, all of a sudden they get more funding, and you might actually want to target it more at countries in that region that are doing well in local development. And it's not... I think the funding model is seriously flawed. It needs to be looked at in to be done on a needs basis rather than a performance basis. People who need money will get money, and that might necessarily be on a performance basis, and it might necessarily be the same for different countries. Your $500,000 would go a lot further in, say, Papua New Guinea than it would in Ireland, and because the cost of living in Papua New Guinea is a lot lower than it is in Ireland. Ireland's a very expensive place. I was there for 3 days last year, and it nearly bankrupted me. Papua New Guinea isn't an expensive place to live. The funding model needs to be looked at.
Yeah, it comes back to some of the TAP funding and how that was being put together. That was kind of a not great initiative because a lot of the money ended up going to full members, but it certainly allowed nations, at least the bigger associate nations, to put forward things that they could do with that money that would allow them to develop properly, and it therefore rewarded better governance, and rather than money just going to nations that have poor governance and maybe a well-performing team that have struggled.
There's not much more we can say about this, and hopefully, if anything can come out of the current governance review, it's that this sort of thing will be looked at. But unfortunately, I don't hold out much hope.
I will say one thing, actually. There is a difference, too, between giving money to development and trying to build a market, which, particularly if you're talking about something like the United States or China, where China is a long way from developing, but as a market for cricket, it's something that the ICC should be looking at to try and work its way into, and isn't doing that very well. So the ICC needs to remember that there's a difference between those two things and keep a dual role of how it markets itself as a sport and how it actually develops as a sport. And it's not clear that it always makes that distinction.
No, I mean, the ICC provides the ICC 360, it's called now, to various TV channels around the world, but that will often get sort of buried in the schedules late at night. And, when ICC events are broadcast, it's not always on free TV, it's often on subscription services, you're not going to subscribe to a TV channel to watch cricket, but if you come across it on TV, just flicking through the channels, and maybe you might stick and watch it for a bit and get interested in it. And I don't think that is necessarily happening. It was certainly the case in the US up until ESPN started showing it. The World Cup, you'd have to pay $250 or however much it was to be able to watch the tournament, and nobody's going to do that if you don't know cricket. And the marketing of cricket is certainly something that leaves a lot to be desired. We have the situation where you can't market it effectively because of the structure of cricket. Let's say there's a test match broadcast on TV in China, then there's all these people saying, oh, this looks like an interesting sport. I'd love to see China play this. Oh, no, actually, you can't play this. You can't play test cricket. And that's a very awkward thing to market. And cricket has this baggage of this status thing that becomes very difficult to market in most countries around the world. And I suppose it's another reason for getting rid of it altogether.
The Asian Cricket Council had their AGM shortly after the ICC meeting. Andrew, I spoke to Shirai Khan about this. He makes a few comments. We'll listen to it shortly. The biggest thing coming out of the Asian Cricket Council is that there are rumours ongoing that they might end up being kind of wound back into the ICC family because, as you mentioned in the previous podcast, that they're almost kind of a rogue organisation within the ICC structure.
They do things that the ICC doesn't really like. Every member of the ICC plays in tournaments. Every member of the ICC plays in youth tournaments. They still have 50 over cricket as their prime regional thing rather than 20 over cricket. And it sounds silly, but the ICC don't like that. They don't like their every member playing. They don't like the teams playing 50 over cricket. And so they're moving to, I think, incorporate the Asian Cricket Council back into the ICC as ICC Asia, everyone assumes. I think the Asia Cup is still on the Future Tours programme. Whether that will now be organised by the ICC rather than the ACC, I don't know. But it would be, you know, very disappointing, I think, for cricket in Asia, because the Asian Cricket Council's methods have shown through. You know, you had four Asian teams qualify for the World 2020. You know, the Asian teams are very much successful in the World Cricket League, and obviously that's because they play 50 over cricket regionally, whereas the European, the Americas and the Pacific nations and the African nations, they come into the World Cricket League tournaments without any 50 over cricket experience in recent years, and I think that's why. So the Asian Cricket Council's methods are successful, you know, the evidence is there, and I think if the ICC take over development in Asia, then some of that success might disappear.
Joining us on the show is Asian Cricket Council Media Manager, Shariah Khan. Welcome back, Shariah.
Glad to be back, Russell. Thank you.
Start with the ICC conference. There was a couple of happenings that affected the members of the ICC. Good news was Oman was made an associate member.
Yep.
Are there likely to be more members that to upgrade their status to associate or affiliates in coming years?
I think from Asia, Qatar is taking a big step forward by getting two turf grounds. They've come online in the past 18 months, and they'll be hosting their first ACC tournament in October, which is another 16. It's a good way to just, you know, warm up and get the admin for a major tournament involving more than 8 teams going. That's good practice for them. And with that, obviously, the ICC associate status, a big part of that is governance. So once Qatar get that sorted, plus the facilities they've got now, they've got obviously a lot of cricket activity in the country. They're in line to move up towards 30 status. And then, of course, Saudi Arabia. They have one turf ground at the moment. They get the second. They're playing very well. They're ahead of Qatar in the playing stakes. And, of course, with this T20 sponsorship, we've got some MoneyGram. It's, I think, the biggest T20 tournament in the world in terms of teams participating. So about 450 teams playing. And it was inaugurated by Wasim Akram in the last cycle, and I think Kamran Akmal gave away the final prize this year. So it's a pretty big and active tournament, which shows that Saudi Arabia are advancing on the cricket front. And again, what matters is just proving their governance. So Qatar and Saudi Arabia are very close to moving up towards associate status, but it's not going to happen maybe in the next 12 months, probably in the next 24. That, of course, is Russell, under the current associate qualifying criteria. That may be evolved or modified in the coming months to 12 months to a couple of years. We'll wait on that. But at the moment, Qatar and Saudi Arabia are next in line to be associates from the Asian region.
In terms of that model, are there likely changes that you're expecting in that, and what might they be?
I think there are definitely going to be changes in the way cricket is run and financed between now and the end of 2015, simply because there's a new rights issue coming in for the ICC tournaments from 2016 to 2023, which means development funding is likely to change in the way it's been done over the past, since the start of this century. We've had the Champions Trophy being specifically earmarked since 1999, I think, that one in Kenya, to create development funds, whereby the revenue from that is directly channeled into the five regions. And with the Champions Trophy being modified, development funding, we have been told, is likely to be a different figure, a higher figure, but it's going to come out of the overall test and the World Cup and World T20 revenue.
And in terms of affiliates that are likely to come up, I know, I think it was Tajikistan's been playing. Any likelihood of that happening?
Tajikistan is, again, one of those countries which obviously have cricket activity. Being neighbours of Afghanistan is a great asset for them. And one of the former Afghan openers, actually a very good player, left-hand bat, Ahmad Shah Ahmadi, is I think the general secretary there. So, you know, he's keeping the cricket going. But again, you know, ICC affiliate criteria is, you know, has certain strict guidelines. Need to have a domestic league, I think, of 8 teams. Need to have a, fully rationalized account, and so on and so forth. So that first step with Tajikistan, Chinese Taipei, and Cambodia have yet to be established. We're encouraging them, but we can't obviously go in and create teams for them to play in their own leagues. They have to do it themselves. It's going to happen hopefully in the next few years. They're as keen as anyone to move up the ladder. And, anticipating maybe another question of yours, Russell, which maybe I shouldn't, but, you're going to ask it anyway. I think the focus of the ICC, the big three, or certainly in development, is that the cricket family has been established. More than close to 110 countries are now part of the ICC, but creating those countries and then actually going out to see what cricket is being played there. There's a bit of a reality check when you realise that. With some countries, even with or without any ICC or ACC support or EAP or Africa, America, or European support, cricket would still go on, irrespective of any input from our bodies. But what really matters, and what's perhaps the most cost-effective, the most beneficial, the most the biggest boost to cricket, is the countries which are able to play on the same field as the Test and ODI countries. So obviously Afghanistan, Ireland, Scotland, Netherlands, Nepal, Hong Kong, etc., etc., as we've seen in the most recent T20 World Cup. So I think that there's perhaps going to be an increasing focus on helping those countries, as opposed to spreading the net so wide that funding trickles down towards the most distant and remote affiliates.
I wanted to just finish on a couple of ICC issues. Am I correct in saying that Brunei has been suspended?
Yeah, Brunei for the past 2 years hasn't been able to field a team in ACC competitions. For one reason or another, there just aren't enough cricketers in the country. It's a tiny country population-wise. And governance is a big factor in being part of the ACC and the ICC. And of course, with governance, you've got to be playing cricket. If you're not being able to play cricket, then, as a cricketing nation, you're obviously a big step behind. So the suspension is holds until they field a team in international competition.
And was Nepal put on notice as well for also for governance issues?
Yeah, that notice, unfortunately in Nepal there are, I think, close to 50 people on the, cricket committee, Cricket Association of Nepal. And, piece of paper gets shuffled around, I'm just assuming. And being a body filled with, non-paying, honorary positions, I'm not sure they actually have a dedicated and focused, member in finance or, in a management position to actually respond in time to all the requirements that a body like ours, the ACC, and certainly ICC, need of a country that receives, close to six figures, over six figures of funding per year. So they put on notice, I think, one of those things, they failed in meeting certain deadlines. But it's one of those things that the spirit's there, but the flesh was weak. So we're hoping they're going to come back and fulfill all the requirements.
So was this something the ACC will help with? Or?
Yeah, it's something that, obviously we have a full-time compliance officer helping all the countries, all non-test 10 countries with matters like this. But, you know, when one sends documents or which require a response, one can't respond for the countries until they do. And Nepal is a, you know, uniquely, you know, unique country in terms of the players, are fabulous. The admins maybe not quite as, you know, great as the players are, but it's something they've hopefully going to learn from and will rectify.
Turning to some recent tournaments, the most recent was World Cricket League Division 4. Was it a surprise that Oman was relegated, given how well they played in the ACC Premier League?
Yeah, it's in six teams, you know, in a six-team competition, there's very little margin for error. And I think there was one game Oman lost by a narrow margin to Malaysia. That was a big swing. And that meant Malaysia finished top two and Oman finished bottom two. They're not a bad team. They've got their associates. They've got the two grass grounds. They've got a good admin. They've, in terms of play, they've been consistent in the past 6 to 8 years. They've been up there, Division 3, Division 2. They're thereabouts. Just one of those things, unfortunately. Hopefully they'll come back.
And Malaysia and Singapore were both promoted, which is, again, a real feather in the cap for Asian cricket, that so many teams are pushing up the divisions.
Yeah, it's good to see. You know, Malaysia and Singapore are the beneficiaries of a long legacy of cricket. You know, there's a lot of grounds here since the start of the 20th century. There's a culture, small culture of cricket. Singapore has strong domestic activity. Malaysia has a lot of cricketers spread out across the big landmass. So, you know, there's good coaching around for the players to benefit from. And home conditions would have been an advantage. But having said that, Jersey, you know, won Division 5 in Malaysia, no more than, back in April, May. So it's a surprise Jersey didn't do better. It's just competition, as we see in their Football World Cup, if I can mention football.
What do Malaysia and Singapore need to do to make that leap up to that next level, since they've kind of been there or thereabouts for a fair while?
Yeah, it's, you know, you speak to any Malaysian or Singaporean administrator, and they'll say it's hard to get the players together at the same time. I remember we had the ACC Elite League at the start of June, and the morning of the first match was the first time the whole squad had been together. You know, and that's after, you know, 6 weeks of preparation with the coach. It's just the people, you know, the players are the ones who hold full-time jobs. They can train on certain days in the evening to in the mornings, and some are in national service in Singapore. Others in Malaysia spread out huge distances away from Kuala Lumpur, where the coach is based. So it's difficult to get all the players together. I think Malaysia and Singapore have some quality players. But as Afghanistan and Nepal have shown, nothing beats a concerted training camp stretched out over weeks, if not months, to develop a team in readiness for a competition, a series of competitions. So Afghanistan have benefited from that over the past decade, and Nepal have done that, and I think Hong Kong has shown what they can do. They've been going on tours for every tournament to get the teams ready. Charlie Burke's doing a good job for them in terms of planning and focus, getting these players who were able to, in Hong Kong's case, fortunately, the players, I think almost to a man, hold jobs with the Cricket Association, either as coaches or as player coaches. So they've got the advantage of always being involved in cricket in one way or another. So that's it. The secret of anything is dedicated focus and practice. And Hong Kong, Nepal's, and Afghanistan's results have shown that, the benefits of that.
And looking at Asian cricket, I think that almost half of the teams at any kind of point you look at are Asian in the top levels now. What do you put this kind of increasing dominance down to? Is it the resources? Is it having more opportunities? Obviously, you have played more 50-over cricket in Asia. Is it just the grassroots are better and that's coming through?
I think it could be just a temporary phenomenon. Because ultimately, what's going to happen is, as they raised the game, as they raised the bar, their competitors across the regions will also, rising tide floats all boats. So I'm sure they'll be up against stronger and greater competition. But at the moment, you're right, it looks like the Asian teams have just caught a wave of success. And that lot that's down to the coaching and resources that have been put in, let's say, the past 10 years by the ACC and by the domestic coaches in each country to get there. The inspiration has always been countries like Ireland and Scotland, Bermuda, who've gone to the World Cups in the past and have done well. So once other associates are there to inspire, the rest obviously want to emulate. And I think 10 years ago, the Canada, John Davidson's, Dwayne Lovrock's Bermuda, these guys were the inspirations. The Kenyans, they were the inspirations. And now I think our Asian countries have tried to follow. And they are doing so pretty well.
Turning to the Asian Cricket Council, there's been a recent conference. Were there any significant things coming out of that?
I think the ACC AGM, which followed just a couple of days after the end of the Melbourne week finished, the ICC conference week finished, was just to inform the Asian members who hadn't been at the at Melbourne that obviously ICC has changed in structure, but the most significant factor affecting the associates and affiliates is this new ICC Development Committee, which is chaired by the ICC President, Srinivasan, has got Martin Sneddon from New Zealand and David Cameron from the West Indies, as well as the associates and affiliate representatives from both the Chief Executives Council and the ICC chairman's body, as well as, I think, Dave Richardson, ICC Chief Executives, and Tim Anderson, the top manager. So they are strategizing and formulating something which they think will offer the best possible resources, funding, support, competition pathways for the teams who can make best use of them. It's all about, I think, just not even reading between the lines, but what they're saying overtly is that the way is open for countries to compete with the test playing countries in World Cups and even playing in tests, of course. But it's open to the ones who can make best use of the resources available. Figures like hundreds of millions and billions are bandied about, but at the end of the day, everything costs money. And it's almost a limitless pool of what can be spent on all these countries. Asia has, the Asian region has four test playing countries below them, another 18 who don't play test cricket. And of course the ICC has over 100 members. So that money's got to be spent, it's almost infinite the ways it can be spent. And it seems that the development committee, the new ICC development committee, will be focusing on those who can best further the game on the field. I think that's what's going to happen.
The ACC specifically has enjoyed a certain level of independence, and there's been a little bit of talk that that might be reduced towards the end of this year. Is that something you've...
It's probably, if it is, at present, all things should stand until the current funding regime for, December 31st, 2015 ends. Because all that money's already been allocated, as it were, for tournaments next year, etc., etc. So there may well be a streamlining, in which case, I may not be available to talk to you in 2016. But that's something, we can speculate on. And, if cricket is becoming more like a business, businesses tend to cut costs to try and maximize profit after increasing sales. And if they can't increase sales, they'll definitely cut costs. So that's just the economic realities we live in. And, fair enough. We have to accept that because every dollar that is spent on associate and affiliate cricket has to be spent in the best possible way. So, you know, wiser heads than I, or more heads than I, have certainly their ideas about how that should be done. So I wait for them to tell me and us how that's going to happen.
Finally, Shreya, the Asian Games will be coming up. I know the Olympics was discussed a few times at both the ICC and the ACC conference. Most of the members looking forward to this, and is it likely to be used as an example for potential Olympic push at some later point?
Yeah, most members looking forward to it. Russell, the Olympic rules are that only passport holders can play can compete at the Olympics. So that cuts out a lot of the Arab countries. Having said that, Kuwait are fielding a team in the men's who are all Kuwaiti, Kuwaiti Arabs, i.e. Kuwaiti nationals. Kuwait's a classic example. You know, there are people who are playing cricket in Kuwait for 50 years, but they can't play for Kuwait because they're just not born in Kuwait. So Kuwait are fielding a team, which is very good. Full credit to them. So 10 teams in that Asian Games men's tournament and 10 teams in the women's. And they're all nationals of the countries they're representing. In terms of the Olympics, same rules apply. And the Olympics is something that, Russell, you and I and many others can see the benefits of participation. But it's something that, unfortunately, the people who actually call the shots in terms of international cricket, called in the Big Three or certainly the ICC, as a quorum, as a body, don't see the benefits of having cricket in the Olympics at the moment.
Thanks, Shreya.
No, thanks, Russell.
News, Andrew. We've got the Asian Games team. Sure, I mentioned it when I spoke to him, but we can run through what they are. It's India has chosen not to send any sort of team, but we have a Pakistan women's team, and Bangladesh and Sri Lanka have sent both their men's and their women's teams. So it may or may not be at full strength, but it's both the men's and the women's a 10-team tournament. The men's will include Afghanistan, China, Hong Kong, Kuwait, Malaysia, the Maldives, and Nepal, as well as South Korea. And the women's tournament, China, Hong Kong, Japan, Malaysia, Nepal, Thailand, and again South Korea, who I wasn't aware had a women's team. It wasn't even mentioned when I spoke to the Anna Cassidy recently. So good that South Korea's getting the men's and the women's team together, and should be a really good tournament there, but it seems to be kind of a good size and a good length.
Nice, simple 10-team tournament, two groups of five rather than, an all-play-all league like the World Cup. The stadium they've completed, or the ground, I should say, really, they've been working on in South Korea looks to be pretty good. I think it holds about 2,500 people, seven turf wickets. It should hold up well to the demands of so many matches being played in it in a short period of time. It'd be a very interesting tournament to watch. You'll be in the men's tournament, we guarantee that at least one associate will get a medal. As you say, it'll be interesting to see what sort of team Sri Lanka and Bangladesh send. Obviously, last time Sri Lanka sent an A team, but this time they've no international cricket on at the same time. They'll have a tour by Pakistan in August and a tour by England in November, so they don't have any international cricket on at this time, so hopefully they can pick a strong side. And Bangladesh last time sent almost a full-strength side, just a couple of first-choice players missing. Obviously, Bangladesh went on to win the gold. They will have just had a home series against the West Indies before it starts, and they may opt to rest their players. But again, they don't have any other international cricket before the World Cup starts. So we'll see what sort of strength teams they send. Afghanistan will obviously be perhaps a favourite to get a medal again. Maybe even, if Sri Lanka and Bangladesh don't send a strong team, maybe they could even try and go for the gold medal, which would be, great to see. And, I'm very interested to see how South Korea do. They've been converting professional baseball players into cricket players. It'll be very interesting to see how they will go. It's an interesting experiment for sure. Recently being on tour, they've just started as a recording this, a tour of Fiji. I think they beat Fiji A earlier today, which is, you know, very good for them. And yeah, the women's side, I think I'd even heard that South Korea weren't sending a women's side, and all of a sudden they are. So it'd be interesting to see how they will go. I'm really looking forward to this tournament.
Yeah, I think the women's side of it will be particularly interesting at even the medal level as well. Thailand and China and Japan are all fairly strong sides. They'll certainly be thinking that they could challenge Bangladesh, and on a really good day, one of Sri Lanka or Pakistan as well. It'll be a lot to look at in that section as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really sort of exciting tournament. I'm perhaps looking forward to this a bit more than I am looking forward to the World Cup.
China themselves in news, they'll be touring Jersey at the end of the month, which is kind of an interesting long distance tour to make, but it's good that they'll get a little bit of preparation in before the Asian Games.
Yeah, very pleased to see China sending a team all that way to Jersey. Obviously, giving them experience on turf wickets as well, which I don't think they'll have much of in China, apart from when they play at the stadium in Guangzhou that was used for the last Asian Games. So all very good for Chinese cricket.
We'll finish the podcast, Andrew, with some tales of poor governance. Kenya, a bit of a favourite for one of those, have let their CEO go, apparently by getting the board to say that he's an illegal alien within the country and renouncing his work permit, which is, I guess, is one way to sack someone.
Yeah, very, very unusual. This, it's he was sacked by Jackie Jan Mohammed, who has been trying to sort of take more control of cricket in Kenya in recent years, and you can't say he's been doing a good job. Obviously, Kenya really dropped down the rankings in the last couple of years, so it's not a surprise that he's no longer CEO, but certainly a very unusual way to sack someone by getting the government to declare him an illegal alien.
Yeah, Kenya's a bit of a struggle. But it's also starting to appear that Canadian cricket is mired in some really quite poor governance, and there was an interview with a couple of female Canadian cricketers recently, which you can find if you dig around from their Facebook page, which had a lot of discouraging talk of corruption, poor finances, and basically complete lack of management at the women's level, which is probably not a surprise given what's happened to the program there in terms of competing at the Americas level. And on top of that, they're starting to have the same issue that American cricket, US cricket is having with businessmen of somewhat questionable ethics trying to run leagues and make a lot of money, and probably with a lot of pie in the sky and ridiculous investments.
Someone, a guy called Roy Singh, which is an alias for Roy or Black Singh, announced that he was going to be constructing a 35,000 seats indoor stadium for $700 million. Doesn't specify whether that's US or Canadian dollars, or Australian dollars, or Hong Kong dollars, or whatever it might be, but
first three, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, well, fictional dollars, I think, is the actual currency. The guy's a convicted fraudster. He was sentenced in 2007 4.5 years in prison for a multi-million dollar fraud case. Nicky only served just over a year in the end, but yeah, I think this guy's a bit of a joke, and I mean, hopefully Cricket Canada aren't getting involved with him, but if they are, very dangerous times for Canadian cricket.
Yeah, it's almost hard to say just how ridiculous it is to think that you could create a $700 million stadium. In fact, in any nation, cricket nation, if you do the financing of that, it really is something that would need to bring in something like $7 million in revenue per year. That's a bit over double what you would value the BBL at the moment on current ratings. It's 3.5 times what its current right package is, 20 million a year is. So the idea that you could run a stadium like that with the way cricket is structured, baseball, you can almost do it because they play so many games at their local stadium and because they can get the local TV rights and it's a really popular sport, but it's just completely ridiculous to even suggest it for cricket, particularly in Canada. So, yes, it's strange that it got any sort of running in even the local media on that sense.
And there's talk about a new stadium being constructed, the Toronto Blue Jays baseball team, and they're struggling to get any government involvement in that. So, a cricket stadium, if the baseball stadium of a relatively successful baseball team this year, is struggling to get any sort of support from the government, then, a cricket stadium that is going to be empty for, a good chunk of the year, that's not going to get any support either. And, it's just pie in the sky. It's, the guy's a con artist.
And finally, the Cricket Association Nepal has disbanded and reformed under Cricket Nepal banner. It's not entirely clear why. As part of a governance reform, they'll put on notice, as was mentioned by Shahrukh Khan in the interview, for basically not responding to the forms that are sent to them, which is really not good enough for a team that has 2020 status and is right on the verge of being able to play in World Cups and so forth. So that really needs to be sorted out as well.
Nepal's been sort of mired in scandal in recent years, and the game is, well, it has taken off there, but the game has a lot of potential in Nepal, and it needs good governance. We don't want Nepal to turn into another Kenya.
The other fixture coming up, there's not a lot of fixtures coming up in the next couple of weeks, Andrew, but Afghanistan has started a tour of Zimbabwe, which is good for them as a surprise in some sense, because Zimbabwe didn't look like they were going to host anyone in the near future.
They will be playing a couple of one-day games against Zimbabwe, then 4-1 international against the full Zimbabwe side, and 2 4-day games against Zimbabwe. I suspect the Zimbabwe side in those 4-day games will essentially be the full Zimbabwe side under a convenient description, because Zimbabwe will be preparing for a test against South Africa that takes place just after Afghanistan's visit, so obviously Zimbabwe will be picking pretty strong sides for those 4-day games, I should imagine. Good experience for Afghanistan. It's a shame more such series are not happening.
And I think that's all we've got for this week. Thanks, Andrew.
Yeah, thanks, Russ.